Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
So this story, it did cross late yesterday. Tim, I think you might have been gone already. You were just walking. Tim was gone.
I was gone. My microphone was off. I was gone. My mic was off.
I was out of the studio. I was in the newsroom. I'm like, what?
Carol stays. This is too much information. I mean, Carol's a late worker.
I'm a late worker.
Yeah. Well, you're just a long hour. You
sometimes
work a
I
lot.
Come in kind of late-ish.
Yeah. I work from home. Yeah. Okay. Let's just say that.
You work from home.
Yeah.
So it did cross lately. It was about late yesterday. But Amazon in talks to join some other tech companies as an anchor investor in ARM's IPO, according to those familiar with the situation. So kind of part of a preparation, if you will, as you know, they move towards this process, and we're talking about maybe a deal that could raise as much as $10 billion.
It's an interesting story. It's one that we wanted to spend quite a bit of time on. We got a couple great guests to give us all the details about it. Bloomberg News technology reporter Matt Day, he joins us on Zoom from Seattle. Also with us is Bloomberg Businessweek technology editor Joshua Brustein, who's right here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Matt, I want to start with you because you're out in Seattle, so you're physically a little closer to Amazon. Amazon as an investor, Amazon as a a participant in this, does it raise questions to you about what Amazon wants to do in terms of hardware, in terms of chips, or is this purely a financial play?
Well, I think it underlines their strategy. This is strategic for them. You know, Amazon has kind of a history of buying stakes in their big suppliers. They bought stakes in a grocery supplier when they got really big into grocery a few years ago. They bought stakes in Rivian, the electric vehicle maker, which is supplying them a bunch of electric delivery vans. So this is really part and parcel of their kind of effort to grab a slice of whatever their priority is of the moment. And if you look at Amazon Web Services, their cloud unit, they have been all about chip infrastructure for a long time. A lot of that is based on ARM. So it's just really natural that Amazon would be at least kicking the tires here.
That's what I wanted. Tim and I are looking at each other like,
there it is. AWS.
That's what we wanted to know, right? Mm-hmm. This is about something that they use a lot of, correct?
That's right, yeah. Many years ago now, they bought Annapurna Labs, an Israeli outfit that built their own chips. Kind of a really good deal in hindsight. And a lot of their stuff was based on ARM. So that's kind of the blueprint that took Amazon into designing its own chips and kind of competing with its own suppliers, NVIDIA and Intel.
Joshua, come on in on this. Talk to us about, your tech editor here at Bloomberg Business Week, and you look at kind of the big trends that are going on and the big moves by someone like an Amazon. How do you see it? What are you thinking about when you saw this?
Well, I think this is an indication of how central ARM is to a lot of other parts of the tech industry. It makes a lot of the technology that companies that are building chips like Amazon need to make their own chips. And so I think what you're seeing here is that everyone wants to make sure that they are, maintaining that relationship. It has important relationships with a lot of other large companies. I know Intel and NVIDIA have also been having discussions with ARM about similar deals. And I think that that is just showing how central this company is.
Didn't NVIDIA, right, try to do a deal earlier, wasn't it?
Yeah. So right. Before ARM decided to go public, it actually had reached a deal with NVIDIA to sell to NVIDIA for $40 billion.
Right.
And everyone else in the industry got so concerned that, well, if NVIDIA owns this company, what's going to happen to us? There was pressure on regulators, and NVIDIA ended up walking away from the deal.
Okay, well, that's a perfect segue to my next question for Matt, because Matt, I'm old enough to remember.
You're welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Carol. I'm old enough to remember, and thank you, Joshua. I'm old enough to remember when Walmart told its customers and suppliers a few years ago, hey, we want you guys to distance yourself from AWS because AWS is owned by Amazon. It's the profit center for Amazon. They're our biggest competitor when it comes to online shopping, when it comes to shopping. Does this at all have the same kind of risk for a company like Arm that it could drive away some customers who are told, hey, we don't want to support a company that's a competitor to us?
No, I'm not sure. You know, ARM stuff is so widely out there, and there are already so many, as we reported, people with interest in backing ARM, right? Everyone kind of wants a slice of this, ARM's existing competitors, ARM's other customers potentially. I think Amazon's already kind of got its hands in so many pies, so to speak, that there's not many people who are
unavoidable.
Not picking their competitor today. Yeah, they're just okay. Everywhere and everything.
I'm just thinking about the semiconductor space, and thank you NVIDIA in a long way, and kind of the amount of time we talk about artificial intelligence and the need for chips in that. But I'm looking at the stocks, it's up 43% this year. And I just think about the whole chip space. You know, we increasingly talk about that everything we do, everything we make, it's all got so many different chips in it, and just how important that is to our economy and just so much that we make and do here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, there was no question.
I do think that is what makes ARM interesting. And you see a company like Amazon wanting to build its own chips for its own purposes.
Like Apple, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And having something like ARM that is a basis for a lot of companies getting into the chip space is an indication of just how much everyone needs to do something for their business with chips, and this gives them the chance to do so.
Matt, safe to say though, so not a surprise to see Amazon involvement, and it makes more sense if there's not only Amazon but some other big players, especially if you think about regulators maybe looking at this and getting a little nervous or not.
For sure, and if anything, it sounds like it validates Amazon's strategy a little bit. A lot of people were looking at AWS a few years ago and saying, are they going to go up the stack in tech speak and take on Microsoft and software or services? Mm-hmm. Amazon's kind of gone the opposite direction, right? They want to go down to the hardware and the silicon, and they think that's a more robust long-term bet. And really, since then, everybody has followed them down that track. Microsoft is working on designing its own chips. Google has a deal with ARM separately, right? Everybody's kind of going after this same pie. And all these companies would argue that it's competitive enough that there's not necessarily antitrust concerns here.
Joshua, ARM's IPO could be the largest in the tech industry if it were to price the top end of estimates, going all the way back to 2014, when we saw Alibaba and Meta Platforms. Then Facebook in 2012, formerly known as Facebook Meta Platforms. Now, does that herald a new wave of tech IPOs potentially, or is this kind of a one-off rather than a return to what we saw pre-pandemic?
I think it's probably more of a one-off. ARM has been looking for some sort of exit for quite some time. And I do think the size of it is an indication of how central chips have really become and how they're seen as the most important part right now of the tech industry. Whereas, as you mentioned, Facebook in 2012, like, it's hard to think of a really huge social media IPO happening in the near future.
Well, and I'm looking at this story.
TikTok, maybe.
I guess, yeah, TikTok.
Yeah, but other than that, you're right. Other than that, there's if you think about advertising, and it's just, it's also dominated by three companies.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Matt, and I also think about how, in this story that's out on the Bloomberg by Nick Turner and Spencer Soper, just reminding us that ARM CEO, that one of the goals is to get more into the data center market. And if you think about data center, right, AWS plays right into that.
That's right. And that's a space that Intel has historically owned, right? Like, their chips have been the typical, reference chips that wind up in all the servers that power email and Netflix and all this, that kind of thing. Increasingly, ARM is competitive in that field. So this makes sense in that lens.
So Joshua, when do we get a cover? I don't know, what's the cover about the chip space? how are you guys thinking of Business Week? I always think about what I always love when you guys come in here. It's like, what are the conversations you're having? Because it just does seem like, I think we're going to get to December and somewhere we're going to be like, when we talk about the big themes, it's going to be, we still have a few months to go, but what has gone on in the chip space in general, led by NVIDIA?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about chips right now is that they're tied very closely to the two other really big tech stories right now, which are the conflict between the US and China, and also the increasing rise of artificial intelligence. I mean, how the details of the way that semiconductors factor into that is critical to understanding both of those other big subjects.
Hey, Matt, before we go, anything we're hearing from Amazon on this?
No, officially they're not telling us much of anything. They are really keen though to emphasize that you know, they think their competitive advantage or a big part of it in AWS is chips. So this is the spot. Whether or not they invest in ARM, they're going to stick around for a while.
All right. Well, we'll be looking for the red sticky to cross the Bloomberg to see whether or not this goes ahead. Hey guys, thank you so much. So appreciate it. Matt Day, he's tech reporter here at Bloomberg News on Zoom from Seattle. Find him on Twitter at on Matt M Day. I can't do it. I just
Fine.
Can you do it? Joshua, can you call
No,
it
it's tough. I'm still working on Meta myself.
Yeah, so am I. If you saw me earlier, I was like Facebook, Meta, 2012.
I've gotten Alphabet down. I can say Alphabet.
Yeah, I'm probably good with Alphabet. Stop the Zex. All right, Joshua Brustein, of course, technology editor at Bloomberg Business Week. Find him at Joshua Brustein on
X, Twitter.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We want to go back to how we began our broadcast about an hour and a half ago and talking about the CPI report tomorrow. It's definitely a focal point for investors and markets, and we definitely saw it play out in today's trade. And in keeping with that, Tim, there's a really interesting story on the Bloomberg about one place in the U.S. that has actually put inflation in the rearview mirror, and they've done it rather fast.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense. It's logical how they've done it. We're talking about Minnesota. So in May, the Twin Cities became the first major metropolitan area to see annual inflation fall below the Federal Reserve's target of 2%. Its 1.8% pace of price increases was the lowest of any region that month. And that's largely due to a region-wide push to address one of the most difficult issues for both the Fed and American consumers. And that is the cost of housing and how it continues to go up. The story by Bloomberg News Real Economy reporter Mark Niket, also Augusta Sariva, wrote it for Bloomberg News. Mark joining us this afternoon on Zoom from Columbus, Ohio. So Mark, it turns out if you aggressively build housing, the cost of living goes down, the cost of that housing goes down?
Yeah, that's what they found in the Minneapolis metro area. There was a concerted effort to increase housing supply. They knew it was a problem years ago, and they set out to increase the supply of housing, particularly affordable housing. They had a region-wide effort called the Itasca Project, which was kind of a marriage of the public and private sectors and philanthropic groups that set out to add 18,000 new units in the market every year through 2030. And the mayor in Minneapolis said that one of the reasons he got into politics was affordable housing, believe it or not. It's one of his big passions. And since he's taken office in 2018, Minneapolis, the city, has done an aggressive effort to increase housing, including by eliminating exclusive single-family zoning so that apartment complexes essentially could be built next to single-family homes, that, you know, opening up entire swaths of the city for additional housing.
You know, first of all, it's nice to see a politician actually say they want to do something and make affordable housing and then actually do it, Tim.
And be successful at it.
Be successful.
This hasn't worked in places like, no. You know, like here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul tried to do this and got so much backlash, especially in the suburb of New York. How did he pull it off in Minneapolis?
Well, it wasn't easy, and he'll tell you, and he told us, that he's still being fought over it. There's a lawsuit challenging his 2040 plan, which includes a zoning change. You know, there's plenty of NIMBYism in Minneapolis, St. Paul, as there is in a lot of markets, you know, where folks don't want this multifamily housing in particular going up next to their homes. But there's sort of a different approach and philosophy in the region that, you know, says, you know, hey, this housing is good, and ultimately it's going to benefit the entire region, even if we don't particularly like it. And there's also a benefit that the region has. They have a regional council of governments, essentially a multi-county authority that has the power to enforce housing policy in the subdivisions, because each subdivision has to get its comprehensive plan approved by this this council of government. So it's kind of a stick to enforce a housing policy as well.
Mark, as someone who's got a degree in economics, this one line in your story attributed to Moody's Analytics chief economist Mark Zandi, he says there is no more effective way to rein in inflation than to expand the supply of affordable housing and increase housing affordability. I get supply-demand metrics. Talk to us, though, about the housing affordability metrics?
Right. Well, it sort of starts with housing and shelter costs being a big component of CPI. You know, more than a third, you know, of inflation, you know, comes from housing costs. So if you can address housing costs and affordability, you could really, you know, tackle inflation, which is kind of what happened in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Their shelter costs in May went up 4% year over year in May, but it was half of the U.S. number. Which is a big reason why inflation overall in that metro dropped below 2%.
So to follow, because we often talk about, okay, wait, what's going on with the housing supply, right? And that's part of the problem that's out there right now, coming off the great financial crisis, right? You know, here we are, what, 13 years out or so, but that there's just not enough homes out there for people to buy, and that has caused housing inflation. But it's not just a simple number of housing supply. It's affordable housing, correct?
Affordable housing and also demand. Minneapolis-St. Paul has benefited from sort of a stable employment and population growth. You know, unlike the Sun Belt and areas that saw just a boom in population that put pressure on housing supply, you know, the population growth has been pretty steady in Minneapolis and not put as much pressure on you know, the need for available housing.
So I guess the question is, ultimately, what has this done to the city apart from bring housing costs down? What have been the second level effects, the third level effects from something like this that YIMBYs, yes, in my backyard, people can actually point to?
Well, they can point to, you know, housing prices and in particular rent growth being slower in the metro than other markets. You know, certainly other markets like San Francisco or other areas where, you know, housing is just kind of a disaster. And it's a little more complicated than that because, you know, other components of inflation like food prices are still high. So you talk to folks on the street in Minneapolis and, you know, say, hey, you know, your inflation has dropped below 2%. Aren't you glad? You know, they'll say, well, that's nice. But, you know, the price of eggs is still very high. And, you know, I still have trouble, you know, buying groceries on the salary I make.
Right.
But overall, I think the sense is, you know, a lower total inflation number is a good thing for the region because it shows that, you know, they are addressing the housing supply problem that they had and they recognized years ago. And, you know, prices, at least in the housing sector, are more stable than they are in other markets.
Hey, Mark, for those who are watching on YouTube and Bloomberg Originals, our producer, Aria Gami, has been putting up some shots of Target. There are always sometimes to data points, nuances, and if you will, or unique aspects. And so something unique, though, also to Minneapolis that maybe helps them out here in general is some of the companies that they have, right? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, they have... They used to say, I'm not sure it's true, that the highest per capita percentage of Fortune 500 company headquarters. I don't know if that's true, but there's, you know, more than a dozen, you know, headquarters of companies, major companies like Target and U.S. Bank
Corp. General Mills.
General Mills, others in that market, which has meant essentially stable employment. You know, having the headquarters there is, you know, means jobs. And, you know, that's also helped in the inflation number, because if you have, you know, steady employment, that puts less pressure on the housing as well.
So what does a place like New York learn from a place like Minneapolis, St. Paul, or a state like California, where Gavin Newsom, just in the last minute that we have with you, Mark, Gavin Newsom has pushed legislation and indeed made it possible to build ADUs in the state?
I think it's that, you know, a little bit of acceptance of affordable housing, multifamily housing in your suburbs is not necessarily a bad thing. That if you can take kind of a regional approach to it and accept that this housing in your suburbs, for example, can be helpful. Because the other thing that the folks in Minneapolis will tell you is that they see a benefit of having, you know, this affordable housing in the suburbs, because the people who are living in this housing are the people they need to fill jobs at the hospitals and, you know, the fast food restaurants and the other employment bases. So essentially NIMBYism doesn't have to dominate everything.
Well, it's a great story, certainly ahead of tomorrow's CPI report, as we really have inflation on our radar. Mark Niket, thank you so much. Real Economy team reporter at Bloomberg News on Zoom from Columbus, Ohio.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses like yours effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Disney, though, stock's down about 2% in the after hours, but a headline just crossing in their analyst call that they are raising prices for streaming services by as much as 27%.
Wow. So starting October 12th, the ad-free version of Disney Plus is going to cost $14 a month. That's up from the $11 that it currently is. That's according to what the company said on its earnings call. The ad-free version of Hulu is going up by 20% to $18. Wait a second. I just started paying more for Hulu again, Carol. This is the second price increase for Disney Plus in less than a year. Oh, also, we started paying more for Disney Plus too recently. It also underscores the company's drive to make its streaming business profitable by September of 2024. You can still get Disney Plus or Hulu with ads. That's at $8 a month.
I'm just looking at, you know, a great story in the Bloomberg breaking down the structure from Disney Plus, Hulu, ESPN Plus, like the different variations. So you're talking, you're looking at monthly costs, depending on with ads, no ads, anywhere from $8 to $25. You want Disney Plus, Hulu, ESPN Plus, no ads, $25 a month. That's what it's going to cost you.
Well, okay, but you're getting three things there. I mean, I probably should get that because we pay for Disney Plus without ads and we pay for Hulu without ads. And the two of those together is going to be $30.
All right.
More than $30.
Disney's still down 1.8% in the after hours. Let's make some sense of it against what's feels like it's been a 24-hour news cycle of a lot of Disney news. Bloomberg Intelligence Technology and Media Analyst Geeta Ranganathan joining us now from BI headquarters in New Jersey. So Geeta, this headline crossing, I don't know, what does it mean to you as an analyst who follows this company so closely?
It tells me, Carol, that they have pricing power and they know it and they're going to exercise it. And this is what it's really coming down to now in the streaming wars, right? The subscriber hyper-focus is over and done with. Now it's all about ARPU, growing revenue per user, and that's exactly what Disney is doing. This should pad not only the top line, but also the bottom line.
Okay, I'm not going to defend Disney, Geeta. I'm not going to defend any of the companies that are raising prices left and right here. But I am going to point out that in the previous life, when there were no streaming services, when we were just paying one single cable provider every year for everything, they raised their prices every year and no news was ever made.
Yeah, but they did it gently.
They did. And they're not around it.
I don't think they did a 27% increase. They did it like 3 to 4% every year.
So this one, do you expect this to lead to churn?
So it might lead to some churn, I think, on the margin, but I think this is really where all of the streaming players are headed, right? So it's going to come down to a shakeout, and Disney and Netflix are actually going to force that shakeout, because at the end of the day, you're only going to be able to spend X amount of dollars per month on streaming, and they're basically telling you, choose, you know, make your pick and see which are the services that you want the most, that you need the most. And they're hoping that Disney and, you know, maybe Netflix is hoping that its service will prominently feature there.
You know, it's really interesting, right? Because we also, you know, and I want to take the bigger picture of Disney, their post-earnings, the things jumping out at you, because they did report, right, their loss from streaming narrowed by half to $512 million in that fiscal third quarter, but it was still far less than what management had forecast about 3 months ago. Give us all the picture that is Disney and how you see it.
Yes, I think, you know, this quarter was really more about, you know, of course, we knew that the numbers were not going to be the greatest. Having said that, though, of course, the profit numbers did come up slightly better than expected, as you just pointed out. The streaming subscribers, however, was a miss. But I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because the subscribers that they lost were really 12.5 million subscribers lost on their Hotstar product, which is, you know, their Indian service. That is a very low revenue-generating product. So it's not a high-value subscriber that they're losing. And so I think that's okay. The street is kind of okay with that.
But sorry to cut you off there, Geeta, but shouldn't the street have expected that, because they came in substantially below estimates, so the street's estimates? Shouldn't that have been baked into the estimates?
They did bake in, you know, about 3.5-4 million losses. This came in, of course, substantially higher. So Cricket, you know, I think they kind of underestimated the power of Cricket in the Indian subcontinent.
Okay.
What else is important? We see Disney, though, lower in the aftermarket. What else do we need to know? And unfortunately, only got about 45 seconds.
Yes, I think the other key thing that we really need to look at is parks. And what are the trends at parks? Parks actually brings in 70% or 75% of Disney's operating profit this year. So it's really key to understand what the trends are looking like. I think, and the domestic parks, we are seeing some softness. That was kind of offset by international strength, because this was the first time that we had all of the international parks open after all of those COVID closures. But it's going to be interesting to see what exactly they're saying about attendance and occupancy rates.
The transformation at Disney, a new Disney, it's underway?
I definitely hope so, Carol. So it's going to be all about the strategic vision. We're already seeing some of those pieces in motion with the ESPN deal. We'll have to see and what they do next.
Ah, you're incredible. Geeta Ranganathan of our Bloomberg Intelligence team. Thank you.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky, so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses like yours effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 18 minutes left, under 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Carol Master along with Tim Stenovic here on Bloomberg Business Week on Bloomberg Radio, YouTube, and Bloomberg Originals. Bouncing around on the equity trade, still down across the board, but off our best and worst levels of the session. Another big batch of treasuries being sold, 10 years. That 10-year yield, as you just heard from Charlie, 4 even, if you will. And we are definitely near our lower levels of the session. So I think we should get to it.
Yeah, we got Paul Christopher with us, head of global investment strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute, joining us on Zoom from St. Louis. Paul, good to have you with us. How are you?
Hey, thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, Romain kind of said this earlier, Carol, at the top, that, you know, today's kind of a repeat of yesterday, at least when you see the equity trade, where you think it's going to, you come in the morning and stocks kind of crater, you know, in quotes, because it's kind of what we're seeing relative to what's happened this month. Yeah. You know, we're not talking financial crisis here, you know, 22, backing off a little bit. But then as the session keeps going,
have a treasury auction that seems
to go well. You know, Dow gets into, you know, the green. What's going on, Paul? It's like, kind of seeing, it's like things are moving sideways a little bit. It's weird.
Well, as much as equity investors would like to wish it were so, the equity markets really can't get away from the whole rates picture. So, you know, if you get a downgrade of the U.S. and all of a sudden rates start to move higher, what's that going to hit? It's going to hit a tech in equities. If you get concerns about inflation maybe popping a little bit higher, maybe the June 3% number was the low for the year. Maybe that starts to make people second guess some of their positions, and they're going to start to trim. So we're definitely seeing some position squaring ahead of tomorrow's CPI report. And there's definitely a close eye being kept on all of the treasury auctions because of the concern that there's simply too much treasury debt to be issued in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, a lot, right? We're talking about $38 billion. In terms of 10 years today, and you still have that 10-year hovering near 4%. So it's certainly something we're keeping an eye on. And speaking, let's stay with the inflation story. We talked about it at the top of our broadcast, Paul. The move up that we are seeing in crude oil today, specifically oil at 9-month high, concern about where this goes, concern about the tensions overseas. How important is that to you? On the equity side, we are seeing energy or outperformers today. And I don't know, what is it a longer term concern play here or just maybe a blip?
It's really a couple things. I mean, if you're going to have concerns about energy internationally, maybe the fear that Russia won't be able to export as much oil because the Ukrainians are targeting them, or maybe it's because the Saudis have committed to keeping their current cut and maybe doing even more than that. Even as Chinese demand remains pretty solid, that's going to put upward pressure on energy prices, which in turn feeds back into inflation in a number of ways. The July inflation print tomorrow may not even be the one that investors are going to worry about the most. It might be August, September, October, where you start to see inflation bubble back up a little bit. Not a new trend, but just maybe making the 3% in June the low for the year. And that really accentuates some negative trends in especially consumer spending, where you're going to have higher energy prices, higher inflation. The trends there were already negative. Maybe it starts to cast a little bit of a shadow over the soft landing scenario. Maybe it keeps the Fed more in play. And so you're just seeing some uncertainty for equity markets here. And that's why I think you're seeing the decline earlier in the day, and then maybe some people come in and buy the low.
It's very reactionary. It's just going to be a volatile time. Very reactionary, it feels like, too.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, 2 weeks ago, Carol, last week, I mean, the narrative after we heard from Jay Powell 2 weeks ago was basically, okay, you know, we're going to toss our recession concerns out the window. The Fed, in fact, has removed a recession concern from its base case. We saw a lot of analysts in the wake of that over the last week, in fact, do that and say basically, okay, wait a second, everything's fine. There could be one more rate hike this year. Then the Fed starts a cut in the early part of next year. What has shifted, Paul, just in the last few days that's giving people the jitters?
Yeah, it's really that fear of inflation. And it's funny you mentioned the Fed. You know, if you go back and look at the last three recessions, there were always people ahead of time talking about a soft landing. And some of those people were Fed speakers. So I wouldn't necessarily put a lot of stock by what the Fed happens to think about recession or not. Have to watch the data here. But if inflation does perk up a little bit, it weighs on consumers, it puts the Fed and rate hikes back in play. So it's just a concern.
But is inflation picking up because people are buying houses and buying stuff to put in houses? And so is that kind of the quandary that we are in as we talk about sometimes the data just kind of goes in different directions? I mean, people are still working. I find that for most individuals, if you've got a job and feel confident about it, you're going to feel pretty confident about spending ultimately. Not for everybody, but that seems to be a big indicator that maybe keeps the momentum possibly going.
Possibly. And you're certainly right to look at the consumer here. But if you open the hood and start looking around in the engine, you start to see that the spending trends aren't really all that positive as they seem. Consumers are buying more, spending more on discretionary than they are on essentials. That's not a sustainable trend. You start to see credit applications being turned down in greater numbers by banks now. You're seeing more delinquencies in credit cards and auto loans. You're seeing even in the labor market where people are getting jobs and wage inflation is still running at a pretty healthy 4%, but hours are getting cut. So total labor income, hours times wages, that's actually growing more slowly. The trends in the consumer are more negative than they appear.
So what is your, I mean, it sounds like you're actually pretty concerned about this, Paul. What is an investor?
We are still calling for a recession.
Yeah.
Sorry, say that one more time.
I'm sorry. We're still calling for a recession.
When?
Maybe later this year or early part of next year. It's not going to be a 2008 style recession. There's still a lot of cash, and you're right that there's still some spending going on at big corporations and wealthy individuals, but the strains on most other consumers are really growing.
All right, 25 seconds, your best investment idea right now.
Stay focused on quality. We like energy here, we like healthcare, we like materials as sectors that will generate revenue and cash for dividends.
Did you like energy before the bump up in today's trade or?
Yeah, we suffered through the decline in energy prices earlier this year. We feel a little bit vindicated now.
All right, good to check in with you. Paul Christopher, take care. Head of Global Investment Strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute on Zoom from St. Louis.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.